I think the judge was pretty good. And I liked how he said, what would Matt do? What would Matt do if this happened?
A sentencing for a drug dealer's role in a drug overdose death. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 5th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, mapping the intersection between wildlife and potential oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean.
You have, for example, critical habitat for spectacled eiders. You have bowhead and beluga whales migrating through in the spring.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Molly, or bath salts, the names refer to the designer drug methylone. And today, methylone dealer Robin Gaddis was handed down a 16-year sentence in federal court in Anchorage in what is apparently the first case in the country involving a death from the drug. Robin Gaddis, the 20-year-old son of state legislator Lynn Gaddis, faced federal Judge Ralph Beistlein in court in a sentencing hearing that stretched for hours as a packed courtroom listened to often tearful impact statements from Deborah Hurd and Dan Scott, the parents of Matt Scott, who died of a methylone overdose in April of last year. Federal prosecutors had pushed for a 20-year sentence for Gaddis and a $1 million fine. Assistant U.S. Attorney Tom Bradley asked for the maximum, saying Robin Gaddis had a lead role in a conspiracy to import methylone from China and distribute it to minors. Tom Bradley.
I think it was a very fair sentence. You know, he felt that was enough time to punish him and to deter others without it being too long. Gaddis is young, and perhaps when he emerges after his 16-year prison term, he can he'll be young enough to still turn his life around.
Robin Gaddis was arrested by state authorities in early 2012 for dealing the drug, but the case was dismissed because methylone was not illegal under state law at that time. But methylone was illegal under federal law, and Gaddis continued to import the drug, catching the attention of customs officials who had tagged at least three packages shipped to Alaska to addresses of friends of Gaddis's. When Matt Scott died, federal prosecutors stepped in. Gaddis was arrested on the Kenai and charged in August of 2012. And on further investigation, a total of seven young men were charged with conspiracy and the death of Matt Scott. All other defendants have pleaded guilty. Debbie Hurd, Matt Scott's mother, said afterwards that she had to be content with the judge's decision.
I'm glad everybody was here for my son. I still go back to the fact that who does that the day after my son dies, asks for his money back, and then thanks the supplier? Right? Who does that? And who faces off on their Facebook saying, just another day in the life of Robin Gaddis? I mean, come on. You can't get by that fact.
Hurd referred to an email Robin Gaddis sent to his Chinese supplier the day after Matt Scott died, asking for his money back. Prosecutors used the email and Facebook postings Gaddis had authored in their case against him. Robin Gaddis will spend 16 years in prison and will receive 500 hours of drug and alcohol counseling, but pay no fine. The state was already looking at deficit spending even before yesterday's revenue forecast came out, but now Alaska is facing a $2 billion budget shortfall. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that lawmakers plan to cover the gap with a mix of cuts and savings withdrawals.
With Governor Sean Parnell's budget due out next week, there's plenty of speculation over what exactly will be in it. The safest guess seems to be red ink.
I think that you will see reductions in all components of the budget.
Karen Rayfield directs the Office of Management and Budget, and her staff is now putting the finishing touches on the document. She says they've been scrutinizing agency costs and prioritizing capital projects that are already in the works instead of starting new ones. The goal is to spend less money than last year. But there is one spot where the governor would like to spend a lot of cash. He wants to move $3 billion from the state's budget reserves into the retirement trust funds as a way of shrinking the cost of Alaska's pension system down the road.
The unfunded liability and the payment that we make on behalf of governments and school districts really is the single largest operating budget cost driver we have.
So, with a $2 billion deficit, $3 billion toward unfunded liabilities, and a lot of mega projects in the works, that doesn't leave the legislature too much wiggle room in adjusting the budget. Fairbanks Republican Pete Kelly co-chairs the Senate Finance Committee, and he says legislators are still figuring out how much of their own cuts they want to make and how much they want to pull from savings. He says some draws on the state's reserves are inevitable.
Well, you know, you're going to have some savings withdrawal. There's no question. I mean, you can't make up that kind of a shortfall in one chunk. That would throw the state into a serious mess, and we don't need to complicate our economic picture right now by these drastic government reductions and layoffs that would come from that. So it'll be a combination of both.
In terms of cuts, his preference is to focus on operating costs before scaling back on capital projects. Kelly says the state still has an obligation to put money toward developing a gas line, even if it means voting to hit the state's constitutional budget reserves. But he thinks there are other major projects, like the Susitna Hydro Project, that could be dialed back.
The other projects like Susitna, I don't know. I don't know how full speed ahead we need to go on that.
There's some agreement from Democrats on that front. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra serves on the House Finance Committee, and he says that while the state should keep working toward a gas project, other big ticket items like the proposed Kinnick Arm Bridge shouldn't get funding when the state's in belt tightening mode. Guerra blames the governor for the current fiscal situation. He says that in the past, Parnell has committed to too many expensive projects and that the problem has been compounded by the oil tax overhaul that the administration pushed for.
You can't keep spending money on everything in the world. We need to spend things on core services, improving education instead of damaging it like he's done the last 3 years.
No matter what, some choices will have to be made on where to pull back. The state has a good cushion, about $17 billion in savings, but that can only last so long unless revenue prospects get better. OMB Director Karen Rayfield thinks that Alaska can improve its budget outlook before lawmakers have to consider other sources of revenue, like an income tax or even using the permanent fund as a backstop.
You know, I think before we have those conversations, Alaskans will really have to be comfortable with what services they expect state government to provide and how much state funding they believe should be available to communities and community projects.
And that's expected to lead to some uncomfortable conversations in their own right. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
In another sign of how climate change is transforming the Arctic, a Toronto-based company is planning to lay a fiber optic cable through Canada's Northwest Passage. The aim is to build a better broadband link between London and Tokyo, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the company says it will also deliver high-speed internet to the Arctic slope and to western Alaska.
Arctic Fiber says it's investing more than $600 million in the main line. It will run nearly 10,000 miles, with smaller branches shooting off to communities on Alaska's coast. Its Alaska partner is Quintillion Networks. CEO Elizabeth Pierce says the project will bring cheaper, faster internet to places that now connect to the web by satellite or microwave.
So the spurs into Alaska will go into Prudhoe Bay, Barrow, Wainwright, Point Hope, Kotzebue, Nome, and we're working on the business case to build into Unalaska.
Arctic Fiber hopes to finish its marine survey to confirm the exact route next summer. The company says it has most of its financing and some of its permits already in hand. Pierce says the 1 or 2 inch cable is expected to be placed in 2015.
In shallow areas, like around the coast of Alaska, the cable will be trenched into or buried in the seafloor, and in the ocean depths, it will just lay on the ocean floor.
Pierce says they're talking to the Pentagon about serving the radar station at Shemya, which is part of the Missile Defense Network, and they hope the cable will also support the Pentagon's new Arctic strategy in the years ahead. It's the kind of project that was unthinkable a generation ago, Pierce says.
We're planning to build through areas that are now at ice-free for at least part of the season, that in past years the ice never went out or never went out of any significance. So definitely climate change and the recession of the ice in the north has made this project possible.
A planned fiber optic line would also run between Prudhoe and Fairbanks, which Pierce says would enhance service for the rail belt by providing an alternate data route. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a judge makes a decision in a contentious case about the state's rights on navigable waters on federal lands.
It's kind of humorous to see that the case seems to turn solely on the word solely.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management received comments this week on the proposed 2016 lease sale for the Chukchi Sea. Unlike lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico, new Arctic lease sales are targeted. Certain areas may not be up for auction. This new approach, which was laid out in 2012, got mixed reactions from both industry and conservation groups. APRN's Ann Hillman learned more.
In a conference room filled with binders of data and shelves of books, the Audubon Society's science director, Melanie Smith, flips through a 125-page document.
So what we have are a set of 36 maps.
They make up the meat of the organization's comments to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management regarding the proposed lease sale. It's a compilation of everything the scientific community knows about the Chukchi Sea. She walks me through the map that shows which areas Audubon, Oceana, and other conservation organizations think should not be sold for oil and gas development.
When you get to Ledyard Bay, you have, for example, critical habitat for spectacled eiders. You have bowhead and beluga whales migrating through in the spring that cut this corner.
Other areas offer critical habitat for polar bears. The Hannah Shoal is an essential walrus haulout because the ice melts there last. Audubon's proposed restricted areas overlap with about one quarter of the areas the federal agency thinks has the highest resource potential. They also overlap with areas set aside by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Smith says her organization does not want to see any drilling in the Arctic, but if BOEM does go ahead with the sale, these areas are the most essential for protection.
If a spill were to happen and you're already inside the important place, you're affecting it as soon as a spill starts. If a spill happens outside the most important place, you do have a little bit of buffer time for response.
Smith says that's why they provided such extensive information to BOEM, so they could make informed decisions. But the Alaska Oil and Gas Association and other industry groups had the opposite reaction to the agency's call for information. The agency had asked the industry to highlight areas that they thought were especially promising for development. Joshua Kindred is AOGA's regulatory and legal affairs manager. He says that BOEM already has all of the information that's available to the industry, so they shouldn't ask for more.
And what they're asking industry to do is engage in resources, both from a financial and a temporal standpoint, in an area that may not be up for lease. And that's somewhat counterintuitive.
Kindred says that the industry wants the entire area open for leasing, not just certain blocks.
By doing this, you're going to diminish the interest in that area.
Without providing any benefits.
Targeted leasing doesn't offer any greater protection to the environment than area-wide leasing.
And on this point, the industry and some environmental groups agree. Charles Clusen leads the Natural Resource Defense Council's Alaska program.
If there's a spill, you cannot control where it goes. It'll go where the currents and the wind take it. So simply by keeping the oil drilling out of these most sensitive areas does not ensure that they will in fact be protected.
Klussen argues the Arctic should not be opened for drilling, especially after Shell's mishaps in 2012. He says allowing it would exacerbate climate change.
A lot of soot is released in the drilling process, which is also called black carbon. And when that lands on the snow, the ice, or even the water, it makes it darker. And that means it absorbs more sunlight and then melts more of the ice.
Environmental groups are not the only ones opposing the sale. 59 congressional representatives sent a letter to the Interior Secretary calling to stop all new lease sales and oil and gas exploration in the Arctic. They also want an overhaul of Arctic drilling regulations. BOEM will now review all 30 comments submitted to the agency before determining which, if any, blocks will be included in a future sale. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
A court decision has reaffirmed National Park Service authority to regulate state-owned rivers flowing through federal lands. As KUAC's Dan Vross reports, the ruling is in a case that spurred public outcry about Park Service law enforcement.
The ruling by U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beislein denies Central resident Jim Wild's appeal of misdemeanor convictions stemming from a scuffle with National Park Service rangers in September 2010. Wild was pulled over for a boat safety check while motoring up the Yukon River inside Yukon Charley River's National Preserve. His appeal challenged the National Park Service's authority to do so on a state-owned river. Judge Beislein maintains the agency has authority inside parks. A ruling NPS spokesman John Quintley says affirms what the agency has long contended.
That we can enforce park regulations on navigable waters like the Yukon River within National Park Service units. And the decision outlines the logic behind that.
The logic is somewhat convoluted, according to Jim Wild's attorney, Bill Satterberg of Fairbanks.
It's kind of humorous to see that the case seems to turn solely on the word solely.
Satterberg's referring to Judge Beislein's reference to a section of the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, that created many Alaska parks and preserves like Yukon Charley. ANILCA Section 103 says state lands are not subject to regulations applicable solely to federal lands. Judge Beislein said that means there may be other regulations that apply to all lands, including state rivers, an interpretation Satterberg questions.
I don't think there's any statute that will apply solely to a particular location, and it's a circuitous logic which I find somewhat humorous, although somewhat disappointing.
Satterberg says no decision has been made on another appeal. The state of Alaska participated in the case on Wild's side and also sided with Anchorage moose hunter John Sturgeon, who failed in a similar challenge of Park Service authority on rivers. Both cases have stirred Alaskans who see the Park Service as overreaching or heavy-handed. The agency's Quinley maintains it's a balancing act to protect park resources.
We'll continue to look at ways to meet that mandate that Congress gave us in ways that are least impactful for the users of national parks.
Judge Beislein's decision in the Wild case ends by saying concerns about the practicability of the law would be best addressed with legislative changes. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Wednesday, three members of the Indian Law and Order Commission spoke at the Bureau of Indian Affairs Providers Conference to describe the findings of their report to Congress and the President, a report that singles out Alaska for criticism. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The Indian Law and Order Commissioners last month issued their 300-page report to the President and Congress entitled A Roadmap for Making Native America Safer.
Respectfully, we think that Alaska is fundamentally on the wrong track in terms of how it deals with Alaska Natives and with the concept so important of sovereignty, self-determination.
That's Commission Chairman Troy Ide, former U.S. Attorney for the District of Colorado. He says the bipartisan commission voted unanimously on the findings. He says during a month of field trips to Alaska, commissioners found a system that is poorly suited to the needs of Alaska Natives.
What's so shocking about Alaska is that you have the most rural state in the country, and you have the most centralized law enforcement state in terms of how the state provides and fails to provide services.
Commissioner Carol Goldberg, a University of California law professor and an appellate judge for the Hualapai Tribe of Northern Arizona, outlined some of the report's 40 recommendations. She says the state uses the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which transferred Aboriginal title to for-profit corporations instead of to tribes, as grounds to deny tribal sovereignty. Goldberg says ANCSA is overdue for amendments that would bring it into the modern era.
To use words that we've used before, the last gasp of termination policy.
It's a situation Marianne Wells, chief of the Kenaitse tribe, says is killing people.
We are fighting for our lives here. We have the highest rate of almost every deplorable condition known to mankind.
The commission is also recommending regulatory changes to clarify that the Secretary of Interior can take land into trust for tribes and to allow native corporations to transfer lands into trust status. That would give tribes a larger land base. In the lower 48, tribes on reservation lands are able to use BIA funding to hire tribal police officers and enforce local laws on their reservations. Sergeant Jody Potts, Village Public Safety Officer Coordinator for the Tanana Chiefs Conference, asked if the transfer of lands into trust status would help bring BIA law enforcement funding into Alaska.
What I'm trying to do with Tanana Chiefs is to build a stronger and better UPSO program for our villages. And I'm looking at your report and wondering how I can use it as leverage with the state on addressing the needs that we have and the inadequacies, and then how we can also work with BIA on this.
Goldberg says that could happen if the state waived law enforcement jurisdiction over tribes. She says the commission is recommending changes to Public Law 280, which dates from 1953, that would allow tribes to opt out of state-managed enforcement. The commission is also calling for the reversal of an amendment to the Violence Against Women Act, which excludes Alaska from being able to prosecute domestic violence and sexual assault offenders who harm tribal members. Several audience members talked about the difficulty of effecting change, noting that federal dollars restrict tribes from lobbying. Michael Jackson of CAKE said to get things done in Washington, tribes need to encourage native corporations to stand behind tribal initiatives. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Tomorrow, we'll hear about steps the state is taking to expand tribal jurisdiction in misdemeanor cases. Half the community of Savunga flocked to the beach on Tuesday to help haul a 55-foot bowhead whale ashore. The meet is especially welcome in the village because of an economic crisis after a record low walrus harvest this fall. From KNOM in Nome, Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
George Newick, chairman of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, says the kill occurred 8 miles northeast of St. Lawrence Island. Over a dozen boats assisted the hunt. Newick says every helping hand left carrying a piece of the animal.
Whoever else was there was bringing something back, even children.
The whale comes at a time of need. In August, St. Lawrence Island declared an economic disaster. Thick sea ice had prevented hunters from reaching migrating walruses, and as a result, the island gathered only one-third of its average walrus harvest. Since walruses traditionally serve as the bulk of the island's subsistence intake, the low yield caused an economic and food deficit. This recent bowhead is Savunga's first whale since April, and the community is permitted one more strike this year, an annual quota set by the Alaska Whaling Commission. Newick says with winter approaching, residents are hoping sea ice will form and marine mammals will follow. But it is already December and there is no sea ice in sight.
We're talking about thousands of marine mammals that come every year with the ice, including bowheads, walrus seals. So we're hoping that we'll be able to take a few once it comes with the ice. So That's what we're hoping for. That's what we're looking for and waiting for.
For now, there are portions of this whale to share. Residents are still carving and distributing meat from the head of the animal. Newick says this tradition of cooperation is the reason the island, even through times of austerity, has survived. Reporting from Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Fairbanks educator and former state legislator Nilo Kopanen passed away on Tuesday of natural causes, according to the family's website. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
Nilo Kopanen was born to Finnish immigrants in 1928. He grew up in the Bronx. He was the first white student to graduate from the historically black Wilberforce University in Ohio. Kopanen's son, Alex Kopanen, says a folk dance event brought his parents together.
Dad twisted his ankle, Mom spun an ace bandage, and the rest is history.
After the two married, they drove north to Fairbanks and set up a homestead on Chena Ridge. Alex Kopanen says he's never gotten a straight answer as to why his parents chose Alaska.
I can guess, you know, we've asked sometimes, and it's just sort of vague answers.
Nilo Kopanen was strongly committed to educating himself and others. He earned a teaching degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He taught fourth and fifth grade in the Golden Heart City before leaving to earn a doctorate from Harvard School of Education. After returning to the far north, he worked as a local school principal and the director of the local Head Start program. In 1983, he was elected as a Democrat to the State House of Representatives. He worked as a state legislator until 1992. His son says he was heavily invested in a number of service organizations for the rest of his life.
I helped organize and serve on various boards. He got the Friends Meeting, the Credit Union, the Fair Board, the Humanities Forum, the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, the Democrats, Crisis Line, Head Start.
Nilo Kopanen is survived by his wife Joan, five children, and 11 grand and great-grandchildren. The family will host a memorial gathering on January 5th at the Pioneer Park Civic Center. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C., and Ann Hillman from Anchorage, our editor. And producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron and Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.